Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. We're delighted to welcome students from Mount Hood High School. Would those students please stand? According to my notes, you're 78 students. I think you win the prize for having the largest group in attendance.
Good bunch.
You may be seated. These students are here with our Court with Class program. Under this program, which is a national award-winning program, the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin invite students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, the students will be sent briefs of the case and will attend an oral argument. And if they can, they're invited to stay for a session with a justice to discuss the proceedings of the court, not the substance of the case. Did you all get an opportunity today? Good. All right. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. Next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is an empty chair. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley generally sits there, but Justice Bradley will not be participating in this case. To the left of the chair is Justice David Prossa, with whom you met at lunch. And on the far left is Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I'll call on Attorney Christopher R. Band. You have, according to my notes, 10 minutes to represent Dr. Fernandez. John Furlow has 15 minutes for the Wisconsin Patient Compensation Fund. Mr. Smoller has 3 minutes representing John D. Hess. And Mr. Furlow, you get 5 minutes in rebuttal. That's the lineup, okay? Good, Mr. Band, yes.
Can I say a word? I explained to the class at noon that the party that had lost below...
You sit to the left.
Sits there.
I know. Well, either your explanation is wrong or they're wrong. So I'm going to rule on that. Justice Prosser is correct. But you only get 1 point off sitting in the wrong spot, but it will not necessarily cost you a loss in the case. You may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the justices of this honorable court, my name is Chris Bant of Nashbillner, Grimstead, and McCracken, and I am pleased to represent Dr. Fernandez in this matter. Now, Ms. Hess is sued for attorney's fees in a medical malpractice action. Ms. Hess argues that 5161 sub 1 sub F has been violated, and therefore she is entitled to attorney's fees under 5161 sub 7 sub A. While there are many reasons why Ms. Hess is not entitled to attorney's fees under 5161 7 A, I will be addressing two dispositive issues. The first is, does 5161 sub 1 sub F apply to Dr. Fernandez? And two, whether the amendment to the pleadings to permit a claim under 5161.1F was appropriate. Either one of these dispositive issues will prevent Ms. Hess from claiming an entitlement to attorney's fees. Mr. Furlow will be addressing the remaining issues. As to issue number one, 5161 sub 1 sub F does not apply to Dr. Fernandez. It is our position that the intent of the statute was to address the availability of health care to mental health patients and not the delivery of that care. The chapter we are dealing with is the Mental Health Act. The legislative policy under the Mental Health Act supports the view that the intent of the statute was for the availability of care and not the delivery of care. As indicated by the board, the policy under 51.001 is stated that it is a policy of the state to assure the provision of a full range of Treatment and Rehabilitation Services in the state for all mental disorders. It also then provides there shall be a unified system which will assure all people in need of care access to the least restrictive treatment. In addition, the specific statute that we're here to discuss today, 5161 sub 1 sub F, states that a patient shall have prompt and adequate treatment, rehabilitation, and educational services appropriate for his or her condition. However, in addition, it also states under programs, services, and resources that the County Board of Supervisors is reasonably able to provide within the limits of available state and federal funds and of county funds required to be appropriated to match state funds. Under this specific provision of the statute, as well as the legislative policy behind Chapter 51, it is the availability of care that is ensured to a mental health patient, and it does not deal with the delivery of that care. Now, in 1995, there was a change where the county provision was added to 5161 sub 1 sub F. However, the history behind that change is clear that it was done so the county would not be forced to expend money towards programs to make services available beyond those provided by the state and federal, beyond state and federal funds. It's our position that this was merely a clarification of the statute and did not change the overall intent.
Well, Mr. Band, how do you square your argument with Section 5161 sub 3, the rights accorded to patients under the section apply to patients receiving services in outpatient and day service treatment facilities as well as community mental health programs insofar as applicable?
Well, in terms of the specific statute we're dealing with here, 1F, it is the prompt and adequate treatment with provided to mental health patients if the county has the resources available to provide those programs to them. And I think that's where there may be some distinguishment between the statute you cite and the specific statute that's at issue here, where we're dealing simply with are there enough funds available to provide these programs to a mental health patient? Now, in the present case, Ms. Hess' medical malpractice claim is based on the negligence of Dr. Fernandez in the delivery of the care to Ms. Hess. It is not based on the availability of the care. The statute supports the view that when the right to prompt and adequate treatment is subject to available funding by the County Board of Supervisors, that therefore then that patient, if they feel that there is not adequate services available, they can proceed under Chapter 51. In this case, what we're dealing with was the delivery of that care by Dr. Fernandez and Ms. Hess, which is not contemplated under this statute. Rather, it's a Chapter 655 case, which it originally proceeded under. Now, this was also the concern expressed by the Court of Appeals in certifying this matter based on their prior holding in the Wright case. The Court of Appeals felt that does the statute provide only a public guarantee or also an actionable private right? And I believe, again, based on the statute and the language of it, it provides a public guarantee, not a separate actionable right when you're talking about the delivery of that care to a mental health patient. The Wright case, they simply found that the treatment techniques were part and parcel to a negligence claim. And having reviewed that case and the briefs associated with that, there was very little dialogue presented in the briefs or in the opinion about any interrelationship with Chapter 655 and 5161. And the Court of Appeals acknowledged they may not have made a complete analysis. It's our position that a complete analysis of 5161 sub 1 sub F can only lead to the conclusion that the statute ensures that proper care and treatment is available. If it's a question of whether adequate programs and services are available, then 5161 sub 1 sub F applies. If the question is delivery of care, then the patient has the rights afforded under the medical malpractice laws. I also cited in my brief the
F says receive prompt and adequate treatment, rehabilitation, and educational services. It doesn't say treatment services.
I may have misspoke, Chief Justice. I have right in front of me, prompt and adequate treatment. That's correct.
So if it's inadequate treatment, haven't you violated F?
Not under the wording of the statute, which it further indicates that it must be based on programs, services, and resources that the County Board of Supervisors is reasonably able to to provide within the limits of available funds.
Dr. Fernandez worked for whom?
Well, it depends at what time. At one point, he was an employee of the North Central program, but he also had an individual practice.
Okay. Was North Central a county?
It's a county facility.
Okay. And were any of his services performed while he was an employee?
Relative to Ms. Hess? I do not believe there were any other than his treatment to Ms. Hess.
Okay, but was all of his treatment to Ms. Hess as a private practitioner?
Not all of it, no.
No, some of it was while he was working as a county
Correct.
Employee.
Well, as an employee of the county.
Right. Now, so I'm assuming that some of the inadequate alleged negligent treatment was performed as an employee of the county.
Correct.
Suppose all of his treatment was negligent and as an employee of the county. Would it be covered under F?
No, it would not. Because, again, the way that this statute is stated, in addition to the legislative policy, you're dealing with the availability of services. For example, did the county have the available resources to provide Ms. Hess with care and treatment? In other words, could they pay for the services Dr. Fernandez would have provided?
They did. And the fact situation I'm giving you, they did. She was totally under his care while he was a county employee. Okay?
Right.
He had no private practice. Let's just assume those facts. All right. So the county was providing services and appropriating money, right?
Right.
But the allegation, and let's suppose it's proved, is that it was inadequate treatment. Right?
Right.
So why isn't it covered under F?
Because my belief on how this was intended was, if it is inadequate treatment provided by the doctor, she goes under Chapter 655.
Regardless of whether it's a county employee or not. County has nothing to do with this.
Absolutely. The fact that whether or not it's a county employee only goes to whether or not the county has available resources to pay for someone such as Dr. Fernandez to provide the programs versus...
But it's irrelevant under a malpractice case, is your point.
Correct.
Right.
Okay. The second issue I wanted to discuss has to do with the dispositive issue concerning the amendment to the pleadings. It's our belief that the trial court erred in permitting this amendment and abused its discretion in doing so. The claim for 5161 sub 1 sub F was never raised at any point during the proceedings until after a verdict was reached and the plaintiffs filed their motions after verdict. This case was filed on March 10, 1995. The Wright decision, which is relied on heavily by the plaintiffs, was decided in 1996. The verdict was reached on September 2, 1999, and the plaintiffs' motions after verdict were filed on September 27, 1999. 5161 sub 1 sub F was in existence well before this case was originally filed, and therefore Ms. Hess had over 4 years in which to amend her complaint to allege a claim, but she never did. 80209 requires either express or implied consent for the parties for issues not raised in the pleadings. There's clearly no express and there is no implied consent either. The Gordon case is distinguishable, and I don't believe that it has any application to this case when there was an opportunity for 4 years prior to this that the plaintiff could have amended. I see that I am out of time, so thank you.
Just one question. This was basically a new cause of action under 51. Isn't that correct?
Correct.
And after reading the briefs and that, it seems that as far as the jury never heard, this was just something that the judge made the decision on, correct?
That's correct. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Uh, John G. Furlow, representing Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund.
Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. I'm here on behalf of the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund, and there are two issues that I plan to address, although the issues tend to be quite intertwined. The first is that Chapter 655 is the exclusive remedy as to the fund and does not encompass the payment of attorney's fees. The second, which is a subsidiary issue that the Court need not even reach, is that in a contingent fee arrangement, which is what we have here, the only fees incurred, which is the language under Chapter 51, are those incurred as the portion of the contingent fee contract. It's not the full award. But the main issue from the fund's perspective is the exclusivity issue as to the fund. The only case that we're aware of prior to this one where that came up, or at least the interplay of Chapter 655 and 51, was the Wright case. And the Court of Appeals has now told us that it did not necessarily make, in its view, a complete analysis. So, in effect, the Court writes on a clean slate. On three occasions in the last 2 years, this Court has said that Chapter 655 is the exclusive remedy as to the fund. That's the Morin case, the Finnegan case, and the Storm case. And there's good reason for that. The fund holds its funds in trust, irrevocable trust by statute. The fund was created to identify and solve an acute problem with malpractice. So the fact is the legislature made a choice that it was going to create a system, a comprehensive, self-contained system, to deal with medical malpractice cases to ensure not only that there are funds available to pay for malpractice verdicts, but also to make sure that there was some check on health care costs, which would ensure that there would be physicians in this state to provide that care.
Mr. Furlow, let me just ask an initial question. The arguable claim under 51-61-1F, which is made by the plaintiff in this case, is that a medical malpractice claim?
No, it's not. 51-61-1F is a statute that is not malpractice. It's a statute designed to make sure that a vital service is made available in the state. That
goes more towards a patient's rights.
I believe that's correct. And that it's the availability of the service that is being ensured by Chapter 51. It's not how that care is actually rendered.
And your position is that the fund covers malpractice claims?
Malpractice claims, which are limited to claims for damages. And that comes from a very simple parsing of the statute. The fund section that creates the statute, and we've put these up on the board. If the Court would like, I've got copies. But the portion of the statute that creates the fund says the fund pays that portion of the malpractice claim. So that begs the question that you ask, well, what's a claim? Well, a claim could be a lot of things, but we know one thing. A claim is a claim for damages because that's what the claims procedure in 655 describes the claim as. You can file a claim for damages. You can file an action for damages. If the damages go over a certain amount, then the fund comes in to defend itself. Damages, when used in a statute, do not include attorney's fees. There's at least one Court of Appeals case virtually directly on point, different statutory scheme, mind you, but it's the Koch versus Bank One case. It says explicitly, damages does not include fees. And we know that when the legislature drafted this statute, it knew the difference. Because if you go down to 655, I believe it's 27 sub 5-3, I think I've got all my subs correct, they use the word attorney's fees because the fund is entitled to pay its lawyers to defend cases those fees out of the fund. So, had the legislature decided that fees could be paid out of the fund in a fee-shifting scenario, it could have provided that specifically, yet it chose not to. And you can look yet one more place in the statutes to find out that medical malpractice awards do not include fees. If you look at 893.55, that's the medical malpractice damage section, again, it limits damages in a certain way, and it speaks only in terms of damages. Again, had the legislature wanted to include fees, it would have been very easy to amend the statute accordingly. And again, to go a step further, if you look at Chapter 51, it itself, in 7A, distinguishes between damages and fees.
Well, so, can I just take you back to the beginning that you say this is not a malpractice statute? What about FM? The patient has the right to be informed of his or her treatment and care and participate in the planning of his or her treatment and care. Under H, has a right to be free from unnecessary or excessive medication. If the doctor prescribes excessive medication, would that be medical malpractice?
Well, it's not
harm.
Your Honor, you're correct. It does harm, and I guess you could theoretically imagine that. But let me add.
Well, suppose the doctor doesn't get informed consent.
Well, informed consent under different statutes tie into 655. But let me identify, because this is a critical question. If in fact, but if in fact we're talking about a separate malpractice scheme under Chapter 51, now you've set up essentially a mini malpractice crisis again. But what it does is, it will do this. A plaintiff will never proceed under Chapter 655 if it has a Chapter 51 claim. Never. Why? Because under Chapter 655, they have to proceed to medical mediation. Not so under Chapter 51. Under Chapter 51, you get attorney's fees, actual fees, so you don't have the contingent arrangements and the caps in Chapter 655.
How are they going to enforce their right under 5161 to be to be free from unnecessary and excessive medication if they can't sue the doctor?
Well, they could.
Under 5161.
Well, under Chapter 5161, if you had a claim for excessive medication,
yeah,
and you wanted to participate in the fund to have the assurance that the verdict will...
Oh, you see, that's the important thing. You're interested in protecting the fund. My question related to the doctor. Doctor might be liable outside the fund.
The doctor, there are scenarios where a physician could be liable for some cause of action that falls well outside of the Chapter 655.
Right.
And presumably in those cases, a physician would have other insurance, like we all do in our everyday lives.
So, what about suing for excessive medication? Can I sue a doctor under 5161?
I guess theoretically you could. I think the proper...
It's not governed by 655.
The fund would say it would not be...
The fund isn't liable under 655. That's what you'd say.
And the procedures under 655 wouldn't apply. Mm-hmm. Now, you wonder about that when you start saying it, because that makes 51 a whole separate scheme. And if you were to proceed under that basis, you have to ask yourself, well, wait a minute. In that case, you've now imposed a set of obligations upon physicians with virtually unlimited liability. And that's what the whole point of Chapter 655 was designed to prevent.
But that goes back to my initial question. If 655 is designed to protect against malpractice, and Chapter 51 is designed to provide for assurances of patients' rights, aren't they two separate causes of action?
Well, yes, they would be. I mean, Chapter 51 at bottom is a patient's bill of rights section, and it's to ensure those rights. It is not, quite honestly, the most artfully drafted statute in the books.
That's what they say about all the statutes.
And 151 recently, I can guarantee that one. But no, I think they are different concepts entirely. You've got access and you have how that care is delivered. And I think the question that the court raises really brings that together, because there is theoretically some overlap there.
Yes.
7A says any patient whose rights are protected, right? That's any patient, right?
Mm-hmm.
Under psychiatric care, right?
Under the mental health system,
right.
Yes.
Who suffers damage as the result of an unlawful denial or violation of the rights, and I read you the right of excessive medication, right, may bring an action against the person, including the state, which unlawfully denies or violates the right. Mm-hmm. So if you don't say it can sue the doctor under at least H that I gave you, then 7A is meaningless.
Well, no, because there are certain, for example, one of the rights is you have to get your mail delivered. Presumably, a person is responsible for that. And I guess the distinction that might make the most sense, the line here is this, is you have certain kinds of rights that you are guaranteed to have. And the fact that there's a fee-shifting provision in Chapter 51 suggests that those are not the kinds of rights that are malpractice-like. And let me explain why. In Chapter 51, well, fee-shifting provisions typically come up in a statute where the actual damages are small because you want to have incentives to bring those claims so that the lawyers get paid. Now, the civil rights things, consumer cases, things like that. And so you want to have that incentive for the lawyers to get paid there. That's not a malpractice case. A malpractice case, and a good one, typically will involve substantial damages, as is this one. You don't need a fee shift in that circumstance. So the fact of the fee shift suggests that it really isn't a malpractice statute at all, that it protects some more esoteric right.
Well, but you've got limited damages in Med-Mal.
Oh.
Limited damages plus taking off a third or whatever it was here for fees leaves you with very little except a lot of pain and suffering.
Well, Your Honor, there are limitations, and those limitations were put in there by the legislature to solve a very real problem. And if we start adding attorney's fees into the malpractice scenario in the fund in Chapter 655, premiums are going to go up for individual physicians. The fund is going to have to charge higher fees to physicians to practice in this state. We'll be back in the same place we were when this occurred. Physicians will leave the state. They will no longer choose to practice because there's a new exposure that they have to pay more for. And that, in turn, makes sure that there are fewer physicians available in the state to provide that care. And when you do it specifically with mental health, you affect the supply and availability of physicians for the very service, mental health services, that the state found so important to make sure was available.
No, go ahead, counsel.
I was going to say, and it may be, I mean, the wisdom of attorney's fees shifting in a medical malpractice case is a matter that's a legislative matter. Hearings would have to be had. You'd have to hear from patients, physicians, insurance companies, and the fund. And if, in fact, you were going to impose fees into the fund in that scenario, that would be a judgment for the legislature to make. It would be a dramatic shift. And in order to decide whether that's wise, it would be something for the legislature to have hearings on and make that decision, especially when the language we think is quite clear.
Counsel, I understand your argument about that 655 is exclusive. I just wanted to turn to the possible due process argument or the fact that here it seems to me that this is a post-judgment motion. Just a question of basic fairness as far as these fees, which are substantial, and how that would be handled. It would have to be handled separately. There'd have to be notice. There wasn't notice here. Give me a suggestion how this might have been handled.
Well, had the claim been brought?
Well, I understand your argument that it shouldn't be in this case, but how would it be handled? Counsel, the argument was made, well, there wasn't notice. You didn't know about it. It would have been different, and it's a post-judgment. But how could it have been handled?
Well, had the plaintiffs from the initial pleading pled a claim under Chapter 51, if that were the scenario, a couple things would have happened. Number one, there's an immediate issue between the fund and the physician because now they have some different interests, and you'd have separate counsel from the get-go, more likely than not. Number two, and there was a big issue made of this at the trial court, and that is there was a decision along the line that you'd want to try this case to see what the verdict would be. Well, that decision was made with the explicit understanding that this was a medical malpractice case and that there wouldn't be fee shifting at the end of the day. That decision would be in play again had we known from the beginning. And third, and this is really critical, if you look at the facts in this case, there over the 3-year course of treatment, Joan Hess was in North Central with Dr. Fernandez on and off for 6 months. In fact, the facts suggest that the false memories were implanted before she even got to North Central. Think about that. If the 5161 claim is there, you've got a causation question dramatically different in that context than you have at the end of the day. The jury never got to choose if there was a substantial factor related to this treatment at North Central as opposed to something else. So you have different verdict questions. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Furlow. Mr. Smola.
It pleases the Court. I am here representing Plaintiff Joan Hess and her daughter Emily Hess, who are here today. Unfortunately, daughter Adrienne Hess is unavailable, and Mr. Hess passed away about 10 days ago. This case, just to follow on what Mr. Furlow said at the end, please understand this, as well as all of the false memory cases that this Court has heard previously, involves not simply implanting false memories, but reinforcing them, keeping people to believe these are realities when they aren't. And so, insofar as there was a concern about causation, I don't think that's real. But what I'd like to turn to, first off, is the argument of Mr. Bandt, which was the whether or not Chapter 51 applies to non-counties. I really think that's a non-issue, and I hope this Court won't spend much time with that. This was not briefed to the Court of Appeals. The certification memo did mention it, probably because it was not briefed earlier, but I can tell, I trust that this Court is aware of the decision in DER, which was written in 1990, that went to the question of whether or not there was funding required to pay for a placement. The site was 155 West 2nd, 240, 455 Northwest 2nd, 239. Justice Abramson, in her opinion, indicated that there was, under the current statutory arrangement, there was no limit to what counties had to pay in order to place individuals under Chapter 55 in placements, and invited the legislature to respond, which the legislature did in kind by inserting the words that limited the county's exposure here. That simply has nothing to do with this case, and I would hope the Court would spend little or no time on that. I would like then to address Justice Wilcox's question or concern about due process and amendment of the complaint. Please understand that I got this case at some point after another attorney had filed this case, and that the complaint was, as is the case in the state of Wisconsin, simply a notice pleading. I was treated by so-and-so, I didn't get appropriate treatment, and therefore I was damaged. In this case, as the Court knows, in this state we have notice pleading. There was notice that there was something wrong with the care, and this case was tried thereunder. We don't label causes of action. We don't need to label causes of action. And this case was tried. After the case was filed, the Wright case came out making clear that Chapter 51 does apply in this situation. The defendants had just as much access to the Wright case as the plaintiffs had to know that it would apply to the kind of complaint in this case.
Counselor, this statute, 1F, would apply to the county as well as to caregiving in a private hospital, in your view. Is that correct?
Yes, and any other certified agencies under Chapter 51 or 55.
Okay. When I tried to figure out, because your theory was very interesting, I thought, and the case is very interesting, I went back and had my clerk look at the legislative history, and the provision involving attorney's fees came in the laws of 1977, and it was the prediction of the Department of Health and Human Services fiscal statement on it that it was not expected to have any significant impact. Now, if the county's going to have to pony up $1 million in attorney's fees if they were standing in the shoes of the defendants here sounds kind of significant to me. Can you respond to that?
I can't. I think that it can, and I think that that's simply a legislative decision. We're faced with what the state of the law is right now. I think at that point it was not anticipated that, I think it was anticipated that by and large these cases would be, as Justice Abramson indicated, failure to medicate, failure to properly give mail and things of that nature, and you would not expect those to be cases of major significance.
That's true, and you know, that's followed up by subsection 7B, which talks about penalties of maximum of $1,000 per occurrence. So it makes it kind of hard to believe you're going to have $1 million worth of attorney's fees for $1,000, what would be $1,000 penalty if it were applied, doesn't it?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. But that doesn't make the law any different than what the words say and what it means.
What it means is what's troubling me. I'm trying to figure out, was the legislature really thinking about this, which is, you know, the way you're using the statute. Was this really in their contemplation?
Yeah, and I can't answer that, of course. All I can say is that sometimes laws get applied or get used in ways other than the ways in which legislatures contemplate them.
Oh, they do.
Yes, indeed. And I believe that this is a proper use of that statute.
Okay, thank you.
Returning to the point of Justice Wilcox, I because this is a notice pleading and because we all were aware of the right case, we are now faced with these facts give rise to two separate causes of action. One of them is a Chapter 51 cause of action. Insofar as there's a suggestion that there had to be a pleading for attorney's fees, I trust this Court is familiar with the procedure employed by trial courts when attorney's fees are at issue. First of all, that's not a separate cause of action. Second of all, it's normally awarded by a judge, not by a jury. That's not a matter that gets submitted to juries. And ultimately, it's done, as is discussed at length in the civil rights cases, that gets done only after a successful verdict. So, I mean, you don't start litigating that issue until you have been successful.
But, Mr. Smaller, don't you, under Chapter 51, sub 7A, if you were going to prevail under that statute, have to establish an unlawful denial or violation of any of the rights within this section? Isn't that something a little bit different than Med-Mal?
Well, that, I think that gets to the question of, is adequate treatment different than than negligence? And I remember that was
more than adequate treatment, though, isn't it? We're talking about an unlawful denial or violation of a right. Isn't that what the statute provides for?
Well, I would read unlawful to mean contrary to what is guaranteed in this statute, and what's guaranteed in the statute is adequate treatment. And at the trial court level, we had an agreement at least that adequate treatment was no different than non-negligent treatment, and I think that's I would be hard to argue something different than that. So I would suggest it is unlawful because it violates that prohibition.
Could I ask if a claim was filed solely under Chapter 51, would the defendant have a right to a jury trial?
I don't know the answer to that. I suspect that they would if the standard were prompt and adequate treatment, probably.
Because it looks like malpractice, and malpractice would, under the Constitution, be a cause of action that would get jury.
Yes, I would suspect that.
And that's your point, that adequate treatment equal negligence equal malpractice.
Right.
But wouldn't what would the jury get? They get attorney's fees, too?
No. Juries never get attorney's fees. Attorney's fees goes to the trial court only after a successful verdict.
Is your position that the... I'm sorry.
Would they get exemplary damages?
Well, they may or may not. Under Chapter 51, they may get exemplary damages, although, I believe that could be argued to be the court. It could be the actual damages, and in a wrongful medication or mail case, that might be virtually insignificant.
What were the actual damages as far as a violation of 51?
They were agreed to essentially be the same as the malpractice, which was the $865,000 award.
Mr. Smaller, let me ask you this. Maybe I'm having trouble here, and I want to make sure I understand this thoroughly. Let's say you have a situation where a doctor is providing treatment, and the treatment is the type of treatment that is medically accepted for the type of illness that is provided, and that this comes in under 51. It so happens that as a result of the treatment, bad things happen, and the patient is damaged. Would that provide a violation of 5161?
No. No. It's the standard of care is no different than adequacy. If the doctor did what was appropriate, he would neither be found negligent and therefore obligated under 65, nor failing to give adequate care under Chapter 51.
So if the doctor was doing, providing the treatment that the doctor believed to be appropriate at the time, and it later turns out that that treatment turns out to be inappropriate, the doctor could be guilty of a malpractice violation, but not necessarily guilty of a violation of 5161.
No, I don't agree with that. It's not a question of what the doctor thinks. It's a question of what is the standard of medicine, what's the standard of care. I'm sure Dr. Fernandez thought it was appropriate to do some of the things he did in this case. You know, he was a believer in this stuff, but medically there was no science to support it. And so he was guilty of malpractice, and he's guilty of not giving adequate care. Back to the question of whether we need to amend, I don't believe that the case law in attorney's fees cases say there ever needs to be any kind of an amendment to explain the fact that, that there are attorney's fees that are at issue based on the facts in the complaint. I would also like to turn to Chapter 655. There is argument in the brief as the relationship between 655 and Chapter 51. I trust this Court has the legislative history. Justice Rogensack, you indicated you spent some time with that as well. I trust the Court is aware that Chapter 51 was enacted after Chapter 655. And because of that, while there is this argument of preemption related to Chapter 655 and the argument by Mr. Furlow that, my gosh, we'll be back to a medical malpractice crisis, the reality is the legislature here made the decision that in this very limited area, just in psychiatric areas, is there a possible additional claim? And as we know, specific statutes trump general statutes. In this instance, Chapter 51, which is narrowly addressed at psychiatric malpractice or inadequacy, is a much narrower statute than Chapter 655. I would invite the Court to consider that while you may have had your share of false memory cases here, these kinds of cases do not arise that often, and I don't believe we will be plunged into the depths of a malpractice crisis. But
isn't there overlap between the two different statutes, at least under your theory?
Yes.
When what are the circumstances under which there can be overlap?
What Justice Butler was indicating, where there is an act of malpractice that also is this one and the same as inadequate care. I suspect that in an over-medication case, it could both be an over-medication and an act of malpractice. So in almost all instances, it could overlap. Now, I suspect Mayo doesn't. I mean, that's not a standard of care kind of thing. Or least restrictive alternative may not be a standard of care thing, but the two examples would be medication and adequate treatment.
In those situations, why would you ever go under Chapter 655?
I don't have a good answer for you. I don't know the answer to that. But this Court will probably decide that. And it brings me to another question, and I have to tell you with a little bit of self-righteous indignation here. I mean, while we can have people stand up and talk about the malpractice crisis, you know, the legislative findings in Chapter 655 talked about doctors maybe migrating to other states and not wanting to practice here and doing tests, and yet the entire organization of Chapter 655, which was to guarantee that there is excess coverage so that doctors do have ample insurance, suddenly is asked to be thrown away by the fund and let the doctor stand there by himself uninsured. I mean, if the fund was genuine and worried about all of the goals of 655, they should not be standing before you saying, by the way, we are...
Don't they have to say that? I mean, they have an obvious conflict of interest.
Well,
an obvious conflict of interest here. So I don't see... I just think that their interests are truly divergent.
Well, it all depends on what you believe Chapter 655 was designed to do. If you say that Chapter 655 was only designed to provide insurance to doctors or whatever health care providers they have, only to give them coverage for claims brought under 655 and not to be an insurance entity for them for the claims that are brought by virtue of their practice, sure, you can argue that. But if you say, wait a second, 655 was designed to guarantee that, number one, there was insurance available because that was one of the legislative concerns, and two, that there was ample insurance to cover claims, then you start saying, wait a second, the fund is using 655 as a sword and not as a shield to help these doctors. So, no, I don't agree with that. I think the fund was a legislative-created entity to guarantee that doctors had appropriate insurance, and I believe it covers not just this situation, Chapter 146, failure to giving out information related to confidential medical records, 448, informed consent. If the fund is right, some of the core duties of health care providers are suddenly not covered by the insurance this state designed to try to give them coverage. So, no, I respectfully disagree with that.
But you have a little problem, too.
Perhaps more than that.
Perhaps. A million-dollar problem.
And it's a statute that's not quoted by the fund, and it's 655.007, right?
Which says
650, that's the exclusive remedy, or potentially can be read exclusive. On and after July 24, 75, any patient, right, or patient's rep, having a claim for injury, that's you,
yes,
your client, on account of malpractice is subject to this chapter, right?
Yes.
So I assume you can see that as to the malpractice claim, you're subject to the chapter.
Yes.
Any limitations thereon,
yes,
and damages. And I assume then your argument is 51.61 is not a malpractice claim. It is a 51.61 claim.
Yes.
And then I assume your argument is to the extent that 51.61 overlaps with malpractice, that is negligence, constitutes negligence as a matter of statutory law, like over-medication. And the one you have here is inadequate treatment. Right?
Yes.
Then I'm assuming you're going to argue that the defendant got a jury trial.
Yes.
Because they're exactly the same claims. Exact same everything is made. Therefore, there is a full jury trial. And the only thing left is attorney fees, which is not for the jury.
Yes.
And so there was no need to plead it because none of the evidence would be any different.
Correct.
So there's no surprise, no prejudice.
Correct.
On the amendment. And you're entitled to any relief that the evidence shows. And you can amend in regard to anything that the evidence shows.
Correct.
Is that your statement of your claim in a nutshell?
Yes.
So why should you lose?
I can't come up with a reason, Judge.
I figured you wouldn't. Okay. And their reason is 655 trumps 5161.
Yes.
5161 does, to the extent that it overlaps with Med-Mal, is preempted by 655.
Yes.
The only ones that don't overlap with Med-Mal are the ones you can get a cause of action for.
Other ones, excuse me?
That you were entitled to relief.
Yes.
Separately and apart from 655.
There's some noise behind me, Your Honor.
I would think that the argument of the doctor in the fund is 5161 only applies where there's no overlap between the malpractice and a violation of 5161. Because to the extent there's overlap, 655 takes over.
Yes. And my response to that is that, of course, the legislature chose to enact 5161 and the cause of action there after 655 without exempting it.
But is there anything in legislative history to indicate that anyone thought about 655?
I wish I could say there was, but no, Your Honor, there was not. Nothing that I was able to find.
They didn't think about it either way.
Correct, from what I can tell.
Mr. Bullock,
yes.
Just one quick throwback to the notice problem. How do you deal with the Peterson framework for amendment? As I understand it, there was no express notice here as to the 5161 claim. I think you're arguing that there was any implied notice. So we're talking about what, the balancing interest test?
Interest of justice or prejudice. They've not been able to show any prejudice. There's no evidence that's different. But the Gordon case is just squarely on point here.
But before you get to Gordon, when you say they haven't been able to show prejudice, what about the funds argument at least? I understand your argument with respect to Dr. Fernandez, but what about the funds argument that, hey, if we had notice, we might have handled this case totally differently?
Well, I mean, some things are red herrings and some things aren't. This case, there's no question in the trial judge's mind, and there's none in my mind. False memory cases are virtually impossible to defend, at least fairly. In this case, I would assert the infusion of funds, the $400,000 in costs by the fund, and the $1 million in attorney's fees may or may not be a fair way to defend the case. But in any case, the fund made it very clear from day one they were not going to settle this case. Now, on the issue of it might there be a conflict with Justice Rogensack raised, that's why we're here today. I mean, they're getting their airing on that issue. That has nothing to do with the factual presentation before the trial court or the finder of fact. I understand that at this point they do create a conflict, but that's what this court is going to decide, and we have two learned counsel to my left who are prepared to argue those points. So I don't see that as any prejudice. I don't know how to assure the court that the fund was not going to settle this case, but I hope the court can infer by the kind of money they threw into this case and what the trial court kept saying about their tactics and what was going on. This was a case that was about, I know you have a vulnerable client and we are going to spend you to death so that these cases can't be brought because they cannot be defended.
Let me ask one other question, Mr. Smoller. Assuming that you prevail on your argument that you don't have to provide any different notice. In assuming, for sake of this question only, that this court would agree that Section 5161(1)(f) might go towards the doctor's liability, how does that get you to the fund under Chapter 655?
Well, because I believe that the fund is nothing more than an excess insurer, as has been said in any number of cases from this court. It might ultimately end up being a battle between the two of them. I don't know, but I believe that they are obligated in this the same way as they were in other non-655 claims. Chapter 146, healthcare records, 448, informed consent, Sawyer, Johnson, Schuster, any of those cases that may not expressly say they're under 655, but they're clearly in the malpractice rubric. Going back to Gordon made clear you don't have to amend to bring a claim for attorney's fees. I don't believe that there had to be notice related to that.
Well, Gordon was a little different. I'm talking factually. That was, as I recall, spray case where there was a farmer had used some
misrepresentation.
Right.
It was a misrepresentation case, and it was a statutory versus a common law theory, I believe. But the point being that the same as this case, we said there's something wrong. There was a misrepresentation after the verdict, actually after the judgment, I think, in Gorton. The plaintiff's attorney said, and now I want attorney's fees under the statutory claim. And the court said, that's fine. It's not, you're not even, you know, the Gorton court never even said you need to amend the complaint. This is simply a prayer for relief. It's not changing any of the facts. And that's the same as what we have here. On the question of does it extend to insurers, by the way, there's one other important point. Please understand that Chapter 655 says in it that the fund shall not be responsible for intentional or criminal acts if the fund was not designed to be responsible for all liability arising from a physician's acts. There would have been no reason for that exemption. That exemption shows that the legislature took out intentional and criminal acts. If the legislature had wanted to take out other statutory or common law causes of action, they simply could have said that. 655 created an insurance fund for doctors and exempted one and only one thing. And if I knew the Latin for it, I would say it. But, you know, when the legislature exempts one, it impliedly does not exempt the others.
But, counsel, isn't that cut against your argument where you just told us that Chapter 51 was enacted after 655? So if it was enacted after 655, how are they going to exempt the claim in 5161 that came in 1976?
It doesn't. But if you understand that 51 is the same as 146 and 448 and a variety of other statutes that give rise to liability for doctors, if the legislature had wanted to limit 655 to only malpractice cases under 655, they would have included an array of other causes of action besides the intentional criminal that did exist at that point in time.
Right, but they have specific fact sets. If I understand your argument to us here today, you're saying you didn't need to plead this because essentially when you prove one, you prove the other.
Yes.
I don't think that's the same with those other statutory sections that you've told me about.
That might be true for 448. It would not be true for 146. 146 is a provision of medical information and not responding in ways that you need to health care providers. So I don't believe that would be correct as to 146.
You still have to plead those facts, and those facts would be specific to a claim under 146.
Yes.
In this case, if I understand you, you're saying you didn't have to plead any different facts because the same facts fit both.
That's correct. That's correct. Very briefly, I want to touch on just a couple other things. 655 refers to damages, but in no way does it say anything about what it doesn't include. And if you look at the damage provisions that were cited to you, those are nothing more than the kind of language that the legislature must take to describe something, but it's not exclusive language. I want to touch very briefly on attorney's fees limited to the attorney fee contract, which was discussed in the briefs. I trust that the court has the supplemental appendix that was provided by the fund, and I trust that the court, while it may be difficult to read this contingent fee contract, will be able to, most importantly, read the line and understand what I believe it means, which is in the event that there is an amount recovered in cases where reasonable or actual attorney's fees are awardable by the court, the payment shall be the greater of. In other words, the Hess family is responsible, the greater of being the hourly versus contingent. The Hess family is responsible for the hourly award here if there is a Chapter 51 claim. Now, that award was admittedly contingent. We had to be successful. But if we are successful, that's what they owe. And therefore, that claim of trying to distinguish the actual from contingent just does not apply to this case as it may in others. The other things I just want to briefly touch on is I trust this court is aware of the fact that we are asking for attorney's fees on the appeal, and we have asked for the statutory the offer of settlement where the defense failed to respond and accept our offer of settlement, as they had not throughout the case, to try to resolve this. I don't feel like I need to touch on those any more than what's in the briefs, but I do ask this Court to recognize that those are issues before it. And unless there's something else, I believe I'm done.
What's your answer to the argument that if we accept your view, then every malpractice case falls under inadequate treatment, and there are attorney fees and no limitations on damages, on non-economic damages?
My argument is that this is to a very narrow population. It is psychiatric cases. So first of all, we're starting with a very, very small population. The second part of that is that it is, if it is psychiatric malpractice, that that's what the legislature meant to do. It meant to protect a very vulnerable population, individuals who are normally unrepresented, who are difficult to represent at times, no different than the civil rights laws provided for attorney's fees because it was necessary as a social good. This is a necessary social good. It's no different than the social good that was met by passing Chapter 51 and Chapter 55 to protect a highly vulnerable population. And yes, I would say 655 gives way to that. It is no different than 655 and the statute of limitations that we argued in the Storm case and that this Court decided indicated that individuals with disabilities are entitled to an extended statute of limitations. It's because of their needs. It's because of the difficulties they have that makes that population entitled to greater protections than the other populations. And this Court affirmed that in Storm.
But if we take your argument to its nth degree, and if we accept that this is a way of dealing with medical malpractice in Chapter 51 cases, doesn't that then bring into play the funds and Dr. Fernandez's argument that, wait a minute, we've got an exclusivity clause for med malpractice claims, and it's got to come under 655?
Yes, it does until you get to, I mean, we have two statutes that conflict, so I accept that. The question is, what's the statutory interpretation? How does this Court put those two together? And the answer to that is the specific psychiatric malpractice trumps the general malpractice.
But you accept that there's two statutes here that deal with malpractice as opposed to one statute dealing with malpractice, one statute dealing with denial of rights.
They overlap is the best way, and yes, I would.
But I want to know if they're two separate statutes or if they're both getting at the same thing.
They are both getting at the same thing in this very limited area.
I'm not quite sure I understand. Are all psychiatric cases involving malpractice covered by 61?
I believe that they are when you start with the assumption that adequate treatment is the same as non-negligent treatment, treatment within the standard of care. Yes, psychiatric malpractice has a special place in the law, and it does because of the vulnerability of these people. It does because of the unlikelihood of these people ever being represented. It does because of the kind of difficulties in representing individuals who suffer from a mental illness.
Is that true irrespective of a public facility or public funding?
Oh, absolutely. The public funding was simply a response to DER, to the case DER. That's just that truth. I mean, I believe that piece in that law was for no other purpose than to address the question raised by Justice Abramson, saying it's for the legislature to respond to it. And I believe if you look at the legislative history, you'll find that.
But just to make this very clear, we're not simply talking about false memory cases. We're talking about all mental health cases where there's malpractice. Is that correct?
I need to step back just a little bit, okay? And that is, it needs to be a Chapter 51 provider. Okay? Then, and And in this case, this court may or may not have all this information. Not only is North Central a health care where she got care, a Chapter 51 provider, but Dr. Fernandez in his own practice called Affiliated Family Psychiatry was also a Chapter 51 provider.
Well, is every psychiatrist a Chapter 51 provider? Let's put it that way.
I believe the vast majority of them are, yes.
What wouldn't make them Chapter 51?
Well, if I can hearken back to a case argued last month, there was a provider in that case who was a mental health provider, not a psychiatrist, who was not a Chapter 51 provider.
Okay.
So you can be psychologists and not be Chapter 51, social workers and not be Chapter 51. But psychiatrists are virtually all Chapter 51 providers.
All right.
Is that because they... Why is that?
It's a certification question, actually. It's because they apply to be certified in order to get the state funding in some circumstances for some of the auxiliary care that they provide.
But it's not a function of their payment in the particular case or anything.
Correct.
All right. So it really doesn't mean anything. Does it, whether Dr. Fernandez worked for the county?
Well, I don't think it does. I think as soon as you're under Chapter 51, you're bound by that law. But if this court chose to say that language, saying under county board of whatever the language that was added, somehow required him to be a county affiliated, it turns out he actually is. I don't think that's determinative of this issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smoller. Mr. Frillo, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chapter 51 is actually quite broad if you parse through the definitions, and it is different than Chapter 655. And the distinction that is important, and I think it's the one, Justice Butler, perhaps you're searching for, is in a case that was decided called Erbstozer. The citation is 169 West 2nd 637, and it's at headnote 6. It distinguishes why that's different. But at the end of the day, what we're looking for is what the legislature intended here. And there's a procedure to do that. It's not enough to say you didn't say it, or because you didn't say it, that's enough. There's more that's required. In this 1990, this court decided Rennick versus Johnson. And it was quite clear that in that case, if the failure to express reference to other statutes in Chapter 655 indicates they fall outside of Chapter 655. That holding was reaffirmed in 2000 in the St. Francis Hospital case. Chapter 655 has been amended no fewer than 6 times since the Rennick decision. 6 times the legislature has had an opportunity to link these two statutes together, and it has chosen not to. Chapter 51 has been amended once that I'm aware of since Rennick. It has had an opportunity to link the two statutes. It has chosen not to. If, in fact, there is a link, it has not been made, and it becomes now a matter for the legislature to decide whether or not that is a wise link to make. But thus far, it hasn't made the link, and for very good reason. As to the pleading issue, it's not enough to simply say we're notice pleading. The fund would never have had an opportunity, for example, to say on summary judgment, well, Chapter 51 doesn't apply to the fund. It never had that opportunity because it was never pled. In summary judgment procedure, if someone were to argue on summary judgment that it had a claim it should win, but it never briefed it or pled it in the complaint, that summary judgment motion would be denied and judgment would be entered for the other side, because pleading a claim is the first issue to decide when you're looking at whether summary judgment's available. So the failure to plead from the get-go means there's no claim as a matter of law. Now, as to the question of the intent of the legislature, again, we go back to the words of the statute, and those are quite clear in this case. We shouldn't be grafting on more words in this particular case. As to the contingent fee contract and that issue, the one that was in the appendix, What's interesting is the date of that contract is January 20th, 2000. That was after the amendment was granted in this case, after trial.
But, counsel, if we take your position to its nth degree, then you really render 5161 sub 1F and sub 7A as being a non-entity. I mean, you've got two statutes there. You've got a provision for recovery under 5161. You have a provision for recovery under 655. Now, I understand your notice claim, and I would assume, and I might be wrong, that you're not particularly interested one way or the other whether or not there's a legitimate claim under 5161 against the doctor. Your position, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the fund is not covered under a 5161 violation. Is that correct?
That is the fund's position. The fund does like to stand behind its doctors when the law permits that. So we're not just putting them off out to sea, no.
But you can't render 5161 meanings, right?
No, and we're not. But I can explain that because, you see, let's say, for example, that you have this particular case and you have hypnosis as a method of treatment. Okay? Now, whether that's good or bad, it is what it is. It is a method that was employed here. Let's say that someone went to a county facility or some other facility that was a Chapter 51 facility and said, you know what, I think the best course of treatment for this person is through hypnosis. And the facility says, that's great, and although we have plenty of funds available, that's not something that we really provide here, so you're out of luck. Well, now that's a 5161 violation right there. There are funds available. The treatment is the recommended treatment, but the provider who's required to provide it will not do so. And it's that kind of right that 5161 implicates. And you can see it from the statute, and I think Justice Robinson pointed it out, which is you have a statute that has a $1,000 cap on exemplary damages. What does that tell you about the size of damages that Chapter 51 is really getting at? To me, it says it's quite small.
Let's give you this. That's only in B. Let's give you this example. Patient is over-medicated. The result is in a coma and is in a coma for years. And if ever gets out, is expected to have severe mental disability. So you bring a med-mal case, okay? And you bring a 5161 claim under F. Your damages are limited, non-economic damages are limited under Med-Mal. They are not limited under 5161, right?
Yes, but you're assuming that what you've described is a 5161 claim, and we would disagree with that.
Well, why isn't it? It says under F, over medication.
It does. It does. But
you're just reading out 5161.
No, I think 5161, Your Honor, should be interpreted within the scope of chapter, which appears at the very beginning of the chapter. And that is one that clearly is directed to making sure that certain types of services and care are made available. And
well,
that is not
how does that fit with over medication? That says you're given care and it's excessive when you talk about over-medication.
Your Honor, there is not a great deal of consistency within the statute. I would agree with you there. I think that the best way to look at the statute, though, is to look at the individual sections in the context of the scope and purpose, which is set forth at the beginning. And if you're going to have a malpractice...
The purpose to protect certain rights... and make sure that individuals who are receiving mental health treatment have those rights? Isn't that the purpose of the statute?
The purpose of the statute follows the policy of the state, which is to provide a full range of treatment and rehabilitation services for mental disorders, developmental disabilities, et cetera, et cetera. It is making those kinds of things available that are critical. And the statute, again, and I wish it were different, but it's not, is not entirely clear as to how all that plays out. But what we do know is under the subsection applicable here, 5161.1F, it is certainly an access to an availability issue as opposed to, say, the medication issue. And That is a more difficult one. I would concede that.
You see, a problem may not be there. Now, was 5161 part of the same statute that put in 51.001 legislative policy?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't.
I want to know whether 5161 was enacted at the same time as 51.001 on legislative policy. It's shown as 1975, Chapter 430, and so is 5161, but I don't know what was in it. What I'm talking about?
It is the same, Your Honor.
I believe it was all done at the same time. 1F was amended later on. That much we know for sure. But they all came into play at the same time.
But what didn't come into play, Counselor, at that time was the right to attorney's fees. That came in 1977. In 1975, there was the claim already that each patient had the right to receive prompt and adequate treatment. So that was present from the laws of 75. It was just the attorney's fees that came later. And I guess my concern as I look at the statute is, the part that bothered me most was that there was to be no fiscal impact, or at least that was the projection for adding the right to attorney's fees, but I'm not sure if that's all that cogent anymore or not.
The response I have to that, if I may, is simply this, that the reason you wouldn't have a fiscal impact because of the attorney fee provision is that the types of rights that are being protected under Chapter 51 are not the big damage malpractice rights. They are rights more like civil rights types of things, like consumer rights, that are very critical, important rights, don't get me wrong, but typically do not end up in huge damage awards. So you wouldn't anticipate a large fee. That's the most that we can make sense out of the statute, although...
What are civil rights cases on discrimination that have huge damage fees?
That's true, Your Honor, but in those types of cases, again, you want to encourage them to be brought. And, again, the best answer I have for that is that's a traditional kind of case where you see a fee shift. You don't see that in a malpractice case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our hearing on another medical malpractice 655 case, 03-0327. Hess versus Fernandez, and thank counsel for appearing and giving us excellent arguments today. We'll take a few moments in recess before we hear our next case. Thank you.